What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik with you, and we're pulling this one from the headlines, John. Now that you're a media celebrity, I've got to put you on the spot. Is there anything you want to tell us about your past before it comes out in public,
oh,
John?
Oh, boy. I got to think about this.
Well, it's been amazing to watch, and I think about it. I think about a Matt Lauer, or I think even about a Bill O'Reilly, and there they are reporting on someone else's indiscretions, knowing full well that their closet was bursting with skeletons.
I don't know. I think it's all kind of sad. It really is very, very sad. And that it's, you know, all the allegations, and if it was let on, some of these things were let to go on for a long time. I mean, it's really a sad, sad statement.
And we are talking about this in the wake of the Golden Globes. And last night, Seth Meyers saying, well, welcome, ladies and remaining gentlemen in the entertainment industry. And I don't know, how many guys were there last night?
You know what I thought found sad about that, though? And I was reading this one article, and I hate those shows, so I don't watch them, but I happened to pick up this one article, and I guess one woman wore a red dress for whatever reason.
As opposed to black.
Right. And so now she didn't support them, so now she's being dumped on in the media. And I don't know. This whole atmosphere is terrible. I mean, she didn't say anything. She was against it. Maybe she didn't know about it. I don't know.
But, yeah, exactly.
You know?
Well, look, we have a lot of people who would love to kind of pull us all in one direction. I think most of us are rowing in the same direction on this issue, though I do think there is this concern about due process, and it's a viable one. I think there is this issue of grading certain behaviors and saying, well, look, if somebody's involved in something that's forcible and is rape versus somebody who makes a glancing comment or whatever, is there not some distinction one to the other?
Right. Well, what was it? It was a Charlie Rose or whatever. He put his hand on the back of a woman or something?
No. That wasn't Charlie Rose. That was another person. Oh, it was Garrison Keillor.
Garrison Keillor. So, I mean, I don't know. It's kind of scary now. I mean, what can be considered wrong?
Well, we talk about some of these issues with attorney Brian Wagner in just a moment. And of course, he talks to us about sexual harassment as an attorney. And he was the former senior prosecutor for the district attorney's office in Brooklyn. Now he is a defense attorney. So we talk about this issue in terms of what you can do, whose responsibilities there are for maintaining decorum within the workplace. And I think a lot of us need a primer on this. Now, I know, John, when I worked at another organization, we did have these sexual harassment trainings. And I know at the time, honestly, there were a lot of people who didn't take them seriously. And they all, what is this? And then, you know, everybody be making little snide comments and so forth. I think people are going to start taking this matter a lot more seriously now.
Well, I just hope it makes the workplace better, and it hopefully makes us work together with everybody better and not afraid. I mean, that's kind of what I see now. I think there's a lot of fear, and I hope that businesses don't turn away men or women because who are good because of for fear of whatever. I don't know. It's just a weird time to be young.
Well, again, anytime you're in a period of transition where you have accepted certain behaviors as kind of the norm and you looked away or you just assumed it was, somebody having a little bit of fun, and it's not fun because of the way it's being received and the way it should be perceived by all of us as being really invasive of the space that somebody else has in an organization. And don't forget, John, I think for so many years, women have felt that they were already being disadvantaged for various reasons within so many workplaces.
Well, I mean, it's in the media. I mean, look, at Hugh Hefner dies and you thought a saint died. I mean, he brought us Playboy magazine. I mean, what?
Yeah, why was he venerated?
It's just so bizarre, all the mixed messages we're sending to men and women out there in movies and everything else for years and years. So it's going to take a long time to really change this, but I hope in the long run it makes it for a better work environment.
Yeah, and I do think we will begin to look at these things in a more textured and nuanced way. So if you do put your hand on somebody's back, you're not going to necessarily get the full treatment that a Harvey Weinstein would get, who obviously has had a terrible problem that many would call, and I would call it, I don't think there's anyone who couldn't call the things that he did time and time again criminal. But there are other things that may be much less punitive, right, in terms of the response to it. Well, let's talk to attorney Brian Wagner, and he'll talk about the nuances of sexual harassment today. What is it? What are the laws surrounding it? And some say it's like the Supreme Court justices. I don't know if you recall this, John, when they were asked, well, what is pornography? And they said, well, you know it when you see it. So we know bad behavior generally as a society, and we need to make certain that we're all helping to redefine who we are and our relationships with each other. It's not going to be easy, John. It's not.
No, well, I don't expect it to be. It took us a long time to get to this point, so it's going to be tough.
Okay, well, Attorney Wagner will help us to understand how we find our way back and what role the legal system plays in all of this.
Well, the issue that is on a lot of people's minds these days is sexual harassment in the workplace. And I think a lot of people are probably very confused about what that means and what actions are included under that category. With us is attorney Brian Wagner. He's a criminal defense attorney, former prosecutor. And Brian, how much have you seen this over your experience and over your years in the law? How common has been this issue of sexual harassment in the workplace?
Well, it's very common, especially at smaller companies where you have an owner or a manager that thinks it's kind of their fiefdom and their kingdom to rule. And so you tend to see it, at least I've tended to see it, kind of in smaller companies more often than large Fortune 500 companies that have a much more set up system with HR and other policies.
And does the person who's working in a smaller company have the same protections as somebody working in a larger company? Obviously, you can go to human resources, but when the owner of the company is also the human resources manager and everything else, it must make it almost impossible.
So you do have the same rights. Now, how well your concerns are actually met and dealt with kind of varies on a case-by-case basis, but generally speaking, a large corporation is going to have these set policies with a pecking order of people that need to be notified, whereas just like you said, if I'm the boss and I'm the one sexually harassing you, you can complain to me all you want. I'm not going to change my behavior. So there's definitely that kind of give and take a little bit as well.
What about the culture? We now are finding out that entertainment, and we've always kind of had that notion of the casting couch and the like, but are certain behaviors deemed at least culturally to be or have been more acceptable in various contexts?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to answer. I guess it's so kind of anecdotal, right? Mm. Different people have different experiences. But just generally, I think what we've learned somewhat recently is that these sort of disgusting behaviors can happen in any industry by anyone of any age. And I think the hope, generally speaking, is that it doesn't become, that this type of behavior becomes less and less the norm over time. And that's one of the things that lawsuits and exposing these sort of behaviors does, right? There's a social benefit to it by exposing other people other people are also more comfortable coming out and speaking out and saying, I also was a victim of this Me Too phenomenon.
When we look at the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and we look at Title VII, and that is the base level for sexual harassment claims, that is only something that protects people who work in places that have 15 or more employees. So the rest of us, if in fact there is this problem, we have to deal with the state laws. Are the state laws generally the same across the country, or are they very different?
You know, like anything, they're similar in very macro, high-arc type of ways. But when you get down to the nitty-gritty of how the laws operate, they do differ a little bit. But the substantial rights that you want protected, basically, to be able to go to work and not be skeeved out by your perverted boss or whoever, generally speaking, they cover the same behaviors. It's just on the margins where this questionable behavior might not be accepted in, let's say, Connecticut, but is tolerated in New Jersey or New York. And that's really where you see the differences in the laws.
Now, under Title VII, there are these two recognized types of sexual harassment. One is quid pro quo. So if you don't do this and return this favor, then you're not going to get a promotion or you're going to be fired or whatever it may be. And the other is the hostile work environment. Can you describe the two differences there or how they play out in real life?
Sure. The quid pro quo, you did a great job of explaining. You know, if you do me this sexual favor or whatever, then I will give you a raise. I will put you up for the promotion, quid pro quo. You do for me, and I'll do for you. The hostile work environment, again, pretty self-explanatory in terms of its name. You are creating a work environment that is not hospitable, and it's hostile in that you are either making the employee feel uncomfortable by sexual advances, you are making the employee feel uncomfortable by discriminatory remarks, and those are really the differences, the give and take versus just creating an environment that's so untenable that no employee would want to work there.
And when we look at it legally, and you've been involved in it from both sides because you were a prosecutor and a defense attorney, is a single instance of harassment sufficient to sustain the quid pro quo, or does it have to be sustained activity over long periods of time? I guess in the case of Harvey Weinstein, as one example, and many of these other cases, it's people who are moving from one victim to another almost sequentially. So it's not a prolonged, but then there are cases where I would imagine somebody is sustaining this kind of behavior. Is somebody more vulnerable legally if they're carrying it out in a fashion that is more random as opposed to something that is sustained?
So I guess maybe a crude analogy I would say to you is, are you more likely to get caught if you commit one robbery or 50 robberies, right?
Mm.
And so you'd think that if you commit 50 robberies, there's 50 different times for you to get caught. Same thing with sexual harassment. If you commit 50 instances of sexual harassment, whether it's the same person or 50 different people, you're more likely to be caught because there's more likely to be witnesses and other people seeing it. And also just an intolerance over time where you say, I'm not going to stand for this anymore as the victim. But to answer your first question, one instance can be enough to get you sued civilly or in trouble under Title VII or under federal scrutiny. It's important, however, to differentiate. You know, sexual harassment by itself is not necessarily criminal. In fact, very rarely is it criminal. Mm. What makes it criminal is if you are doing some sort of sexual act that is criminal by itself. For example, if you are forcibly touching someone against their will, then in New York it would be an assault. In Connecticut it might be a battery, a sexual assault, a sexual battery, and so on. But if you simply say to an employee a sexist remark, that's probably not going to be criminal because I can't really think of a a sexual remark in just words, that would rise to the level of criminal.
But are you worried, as an attorney, in a litigious society like ours, that now there may be that onslaught of cases that are going to be some incredibly serious and very disturbing, and others that are really not meant to be threatening to the employee and maybe just rude or somebody unthinking? Are you worried about those distinctions going forward?
No, I think, generally speaking, people are smart. People understand that there are varying levels of instances, whether it be sexual or criminal, like we just talked about. And on a case-by-case basis, attorneys, when they're involved, are able to say, this is not the crime of the century, or this is the most egregious thing I've ever seen. And then we're just talking about what is the appropriate remedy, what's the appropriate sanction, what's the appropriate punishment, and when reasonable minds talk about it, usually you're able to come up with a settlement that both sides are a little bit unhappy with and both sides are a little bit happy with. Those are the best resolutions, when everyone agrees that they got a little less than they wanted, but they also got a little more than they wanted.
When you hear people coming forward, and I hear certain people say, well, how can somebody be believed because they kept this to themselves for 20, 30, 40 years? And I understand exactly why that is, because a lot of people think, well, they must have done something wrong, or it was upon them, or they felt the power imbalance and they never thought anybody would listen. So I do understand that. But from a legal standpoint, a lot of people probably can't prosecute a case. But they are able today, with the Me Too movement, to move people out of positions of power. And some say, well, where's due process in this? As an attorney, how do you look at all of this?
So there's actually a term for that very thing. It's called an outcry witness. And what an outcry witness is, who did the victim first tell, and when did they tell them, under what circumstances did they tell them, and how many days, months, hours, or years later did they first report this sexual incident? And like anything else, as an attorney, you evaluate the accusation based on all those complex facts that are pulling and pushing against one another. So in terms of people that wait 40 years to make a complaint, sometimes it's just that society has changed and now it's socially acceptable to come out and be a complainant and say, you know what, this happened to me 40 years ago, and I didn't realize it at the time, but this was wrong, or I did realize it at the time, and it was wrong, but I wasn't in a position where I thought I would be believed. And so I think what you said is absolutely correct. You have to look at these cases on a case-by-case basis and then decide for yourselves. And reasonable people are going to come to different answers, whether or not to believe someone, but you evaluate the facts as they kind of come to you.
When you look at the laws and the way they're established, and we talked about the Civil Rights Act of 1964, generally speaking, are the laws related to sexual harassment, particularly in the workplace, are they set up to protect the accuser or the accused? I mean, how are they set up?
So they are definitely not set up to protect the person being accused. In the criminal system, generally speaking, the laws are there to protect the accused, because the last thing you want to do is convict an innocent person. In the workplace, in the civil context, what the laws are set up to do is to encourage people that have been a victim or seen someone be a victim of sexual harassment to report them. And the way the laws set that up and the way they encourage people to come forward is by offering them protections against being retaliated against, being punished for making some sort of complaint. And the retaliation means you're not allowed to be skipped over for a promotion that you are probably entitled to. You're not allowed to be demoted. You're not allowed to be sent away. You can't take any negative steps against someone who comes forward with a good faith allegation. That's the key phrase, though. It has to be good faith. You can't make something up out of the thin blue air and then expect to be protected as well. So whether or not the allegation is true doesn't matter, but it does have to be one based in good faith.
What is a hostile work environment? I mean, how does one in a courtroom or even in an arbitration really determine that this really was one of those? I mean, we've all been in work environments that are not friendly and that are dysfunctional, but what is a hostile work environment?
Well, it's like we talked about, right? It's, you know it when you see it. If every day I walk into work and someone pinches me on the bottom, and it makes me uncomfortable, that's going to be a hostile work environment. Now, there is a specific legal definition, but if you just think about it common sense and logically, that's usually the best way to get there. It's, does the work environment create a place or an atmosphere that the employee would feel uncomfortable? That's really what it boils down to, and that's an issue of fact for a jury to determine. There's minimum levels that a judge can say this doesn't meet it, but generally speaking, it's a factual determination that that a jury is going to have to come out and make a decision on.
And when we look at the various ways that someone can interpret something as being harassment, it can be verbal, it could be physical. We talked a bit about the frequency of this conduct and whether it's ongoing. Whether, in fact, it's hostile versus just offensive or unthinking or uncaring, whether, in fact, you are in some direct supervisory capacity, how much do all of these things play in to the way a judge or a jury might look at what's been going on in this particular work environment?
Well, they're all important facts. They're all criteria that a judge and a jury are going to look at and make a determination as to how much weight to give them. Generally speaking, the law won't tell a jury or even a judge how they're supposed to weigh things in terms of their probative value, how much they're worth in terms of a case. But if the actions are so severe that someone feels deeply uncomfortable every day, and a reasonable person, just your average everyday Joe would say, that's just not right, then a jury is going to give that a lot of credence. If it's a, you know, something that one person, this subjectively, one person really found disheartening, but the rest of society probably would not agree with, then the jury is not going to give that much credit, I would imagine.
And what are we talking about here? Are we talking about compensatory damages? Are we talking about somebody saying, well, you know, I really should have been promoted because I had all the abilities, but because I would not offer a quid pro quo in terms of a sexual favor, I was passed over. So therefore, the last 2 years I was there, I was being undercompensated by X, or this so disturbed me that I never reached my fuller potential. I know it's 10 years down the road. Contemporaneously, I did tell my friends what happened here, and I did document this, and I've had a lot of pain and suffering, or punitive damage. How do you really make that assessment of the impact that this has had on someone's life years down the road or in the immediate sense?
So it depends on the act, right? If we're looking at a guy like Harvey Weinstein, who's repeated, and these are just allegations, if the repeated allegations are true, then I think you're more likely to see a jury come back with punitive damages, because punitive damages are meant to punish, and they're meant to dissuade people from acting a certain way. And so in that case, you might have a jury that comes back and says, look, this behavior, he needs to be taught a lesson, and other people in similar situations need to be taught a lesson as well. Compensatory damages are to compensate you. And so those tend to be lesser amounts because they're not meant to punish. They're meant to just compensate you for what your actual loss was. So in the example you provided, you know, if I never reach my full potential, is that because of what happened in my workplace. I would have to prove that my inability to reach my potential was a direct result of this employer's behavior towards me. At a certain point, it gets kind of tenuous and a little hard to connect those dots. And the more distance between those, the less likely you are to obtain some sort of compensatory damages.
What's a company's best response? Can they say, well, this was one person acting out alone, and we really didn't know, we weren't aware? Or is it better if they can say, these are the steps that we have taken, all the trainings that we're requiring, we rooted this bad apple out, we did X, Y, and Z. What is the company's best response?
So the best response is, before anything happens, have a hostile work environment policy set up and tell your employees about it. When they first start working there, give it to them in a pamphlet. When they go through their annual review, give it to them in a pamphlet. Tell them about it. Make sure they understand that they could always report to a supervisor. If the supervisor is the person committing the acts, go to an equal level supervisor or the HR department. Have a policy in writing that everyone understands and that you publicize and make sure your employees understand it. That's step one. Now, when the company receives notice of some sort of improper behavior, they should investigate it. And they should investigate it diligently and without a view of, you know, this is probably nonsense. They should give it an honest investigation. And if that means temporarily suspending the supervisor because they've found that there's at least a likelihood of it being true, so be it. But what they should absolutely not do is, like we talked about, retaliate against the person making the claim, because that's when they could really get into some trouble in terms of civil liability and even go foul of the Civil Rights Act.
Did you suggest earlier that you don't think that a lot of what's coming out today is going to dredge up some bad experiences, perhaps, that people had, but maybe are thought of in ways that go beyond some of the laws that protect people against sexual harassment? Maybe it was just somebody they didn't like in a workplace. Are you at all worried that there might be a little bit of mob rule going on? And if somebody came to you and said, well, what are my rights? Because I think somebody is coming after me about something I did, but I don't think anything I did was untoward.
There's always a possibility, but I think for the most part, that's not going to happen because attorneys have jobs to do. And when a client comes into my office and my colleagues' offices, the first thing we ask ourselves, whether we say it out loud or not, is, does this person have a viable, real case? Because I only have so many hours in a day I could spend my time on work. And so if I'm going to invest my time and my energy into a case, it's not going to be a case that's frivolous. And generally speaking, the people in my field and my colleagues have the same take on it. So those frivolous cases that really don't have a real legal legs to stand on are going to get weeded out just by their own natural selection.
But how do you do that? I mean, how do you know that what was in somebody's heart when they said something or did something? I mean, how do you assess that on the part of somebody coming into your office?
Oh, okay. So then the issue is not whether or not this action actually occurred. Then it's, how did Jane victim or Joe victim that walked in my office actually perceive the words? Whether or not Joe employer meant, or Jane employer meant to be inappropriate, sometimes it doesn't matter. What matters is how the victim actually received it. And we were talking before about how would a jury determine this, right? This is a factual determination that the jury's going to have to sit back and say, you know, I understand that I don't feel the same way as Jane or John victim, but I understand why they were honestly and truly offended and created this hostile work environment for them, and therefore we're going to find that the employer was or was not liable. And so that is, you just speak to the person and figure out to the best that you can what their real injury was. And if it's a minimal injury, maybe you're still going to pass on the case because it's not worth your time and you don't think the case is going to go anywhere. But maybe if you really believe that victim, and although they're one out of a million that would actually be offended, they have the right to get recourse just like any other victim would.
Well, in the case of Al Franken, I mean, he said something similar to that. I didn't really mean what it is that I'm accused of in many of these cases, but if somebody felt that I had made them feel very uncomfortable, so on and so forth. And he was kind of drummed out of the Senate. It was obviously involved politics among, party members, but, he was ready to go to an ethics panel. I don't know that any of these cases would have led to anything that involved a court or a jury or a lawyer. But, as you looked at that case, what was that emblematic of?
That's exactly emblematic of what we just talked about, right? People say stupid jokes that are ill-advised all the time. Maybe they didn't mean anything by it, but when you say a joke that's ill-advised, sometimes you don't know how the person on the other end is going to receive it. And the person receiving the joke or receiving the insult has just as much of a right to be in a hostile-free environment as the person making the joke. And in Al Franken's case that we talked about, it's what he says probably rings true, that maybe he didn't intend it that way, but the victim that heard it or was the recipient of it certainly felt that it created a hostile environment, and that's enough. And, that's reasonable minds can differ, but that's why your employer tells you err on the side of caution.
And what about the private employer who is not perhaps bound by due process, but feeling that, gee, I don't want this to go any further. I've heard from an employee, they think their supervisor is doing something untoward, and they fired the employee on suspicion of improper behavior. Are they well within their rights to do that?
Firing the employee or?
Not the person who came forward, but the supervisor who was performing these threatening acts or ways that had been interpreted to be threatening.
Yeah, so long the employer believes that the complaint was made in good faith, meaning honest, and that the victim truly believed this happened, then the employer is probably in good standing to discharge the supervisor. Now, like anything else, it's going to come down to a business decision as well, right? If that's your best supervisor and a person that you rely on, maybe you're less likely to let that person go and more likely to put them into a different area of the business. But sometimes with small businesses, that's just simply not possible. So in terms of that, the employer really has a lot of leeway what he or she wants to do with the supervisor that commits these acts.
As we look at it going forward, given the new heightened sense of concern about this issue, what do you see happening in the future? Do you think more cases will be brought? Do you think more people will be rooted out based upon the fact that there's a commonality of understanding that this is a person who has acted in this way, and now while we accepted it in the past, we're not going to accept it any longer, and so a lot of this will be self-regulated? What do you think is going to be happening, Attorney Wagner, over the coming period in America, given all the attention drawn to this?
Man, I wish I knew, because there's two competing forces, right? There's the victims are now empowered, and they say, look, other people are getting justice. I deserve it too, and I'm going to speak out against it. And so that would create more cases. But on the other end, employers and supervisors are now becoming more intelligent and more aware and understanding that this behavior is not permitted. So that would, you'd think, create fewer cases. So I don't know if there's going to be more or less cases, but what I hope is that this behavior stops. one way or the other, it should stop. And I think we generally all agree that people should feel comfortable in their own skin when they're at work or at any other place where these laws would apply. So I don't know if there's going to be more or less cases, but I'm interested to see how it plays out, just like you.
We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All right. Well, that dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, we put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And stay in touch with us on both Facebook and Twitter at Trends Podcast. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter. That's right. Where the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well, you can direct message us at Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
They can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website, and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time, and we'll lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
We now return to this episode of America Trends.
And in closing, I just want to go back over one point about the aging of some of the material, because there are a lot of people who come to an awareness of something that happened to them years later in retrospect, or something kind of commands that they respond to this psychologically because it's had an impact that they've tried to sublimate for so many years. Do you find that when people do come forward many years later that they should be given or are given the same credence as those who might immediately make a response?
So generally speaking, I think yes, they should be given the same ability to be believed, but in practice they're not. And what I tell witnesses and clients and victims and witnesses all the time is juries, judges, they're people, and what they want to know are common sense things. So if you didn't tell anyone about this incident for 30 years, for 20 years, why? If there's a common sense explanation that just makes sense and it's normal and you say, yeah, I get it, then that person has a chance of being believed. But if their explanation for why they never came forward is outlandish, well, because I went to Mars and I was unavailable, then who's going to believe them? So really what it comes down to is the reason they didn't come forward common sense and logic and something that the average person will say, I get it. I understand. And do you know what? I empathize with them. That's what it comes down to.
Thank you very much, Attorney Brian Wagner, for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to this edition of America Trends.